From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Rick Snyder makes it official, kicking off his reelection campaign.
Time to continue the reinvention of Michigan. We're the comeback state, but there's more work to be done.
Then, a new survey is out. What do local leaders in Michigan think of Detroit's bankruptcy?
56% of these local leaders think that filing for bankruptcy was the right thing to do in this case.
Plus, a Michigan man is making it snow in Sochi.
It takes a whole lot of water and a lot of technology and energy.
And a veteran musician finds new inspiration jamming with his grandsons.
It's hard to imagine, but we act more as peers than as relatives because we're all working for a common goal, which is creating good music.
We'll have those stories and much more on Stateside. From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder is officially launching his reelection bid today. That's after a 60-second ad ran throughout much of the state last night during the Super Bowl.
Some call him a nerd. But Michigan now calls him the comeback kid.
Coming up on today's show, Michigan Public Radio's Rick Pluta will join us to talk about the politics behind that ad, about Snyder's reelection bid, and his likely Democratic opponent, Mark Schauer. But first, let's go straight to the source himself. Governor Snyder joins us now from the road, traveling between campaign stops. Hello, Governor.
It's great to be with you, Zoe.
So between today and tomorrow, you're hitting six cities, kicking off your reelection. What are we going to hear from you on those stops?
Well, it's time to continue the reinvention of Michigan. We're the comeback state, but there's more work to be done. It's an honor to be governor, and I'd like to continue in that path because I think there's still more to be done on more and better jobs and a future for our kids.
So what issues in particular are you going to be focusing on?
Well, those are the two big topics. Again, we've made tremendous progress. We've added over 220,000 private sector jobs in the last 3 years, but there's still more opportunities there. And so a lot of it is working on areas such as skilled trade training, the whole career tech education area. We have a lot of companies that have openings, for example, for welders, for production people that run robotics equipment, and those jobs aren't being filled, and yet at the same time, we have very talented people looking for careers. So a lot of it is, let's do a better job of helping be the matchmaker to bring those parties together so there can be successful careers. And I think that's a great opportunity we've already started, but there's more to be done.
Governor, the issue of increasing the state and federal minimum wage has been making headlines. A group here in Michigan is looking to raise the hourly wage through a ballot initiative. Last fall, you said raising the minimum wage was not a significant issue for your administration. Why not?
Well, we're focused on helping well-paying jobs at all levels. So again, helping people find a position is critically important. And the goal should be to find better-paying jobs. And that's why I'm proud to say, if you look at the record in Michigan, we're number four in creating high-paying jobs over the last 2 or 3 years. We're number six in medium-paying jobs. And I'll give you an illustration, Zoe. One of the programs I'm proudest of is something called Community Ventures for the structurally unemployed. And so these are people that traditionally have had trouble even holding a job. And we've worked hard. We've placed over 1,000 people, 1,200 people in positions, and their average wage is $11.50 an hour. So that's something where, isn't it great that we were able to work on a program for the structurally unemployed? We were able to get them a pay scale well above what would be a minimum wage. That's a good success. Let's keep that up.
But if a minimum wage gets on the ballot, is that something you would campaign against?
Oh, well, I respect, you know, people going through the democratic process. So we've had ballot initiatives in the past, and the way I view it is people can have an opportunity to then vote on it. So my focus is, again, more and better jobs for everyone. How do we raise personal income levels? And again, we're showing great results. The job creation has been good. In terms of personal income in our state, we've tied for first in the Great Lakes states, and we're number seven in the country. So it's, how do we help raise wage levels for people across the board so they can be successful and have upward mobility?
Sure, and you just mentioned some statistics, and the message of your campaign right now, at least for those who saw your Super Bowl ad last night, is comeback. But speaking of statistics, Mark Schauer, your likely opponent, has been talking about the fact that Michigan has the fourth highest unemployment rate. Politico recently rated the state 36th in overall strength. Is it fair to call it a comeback?
Oh, absolutely. Again, you have to go, we had the lost decade. In the last decade, in terms of we've dropped unemployment more than any other state, and that's something we should be proud of. And in fact, we're seeing the labor force increase again because people are beginning to have more confidence about finding work in Michigan. That's a good answer. So let's keep focused on creating more and better jobs. Let's keep on finding, you know, higher paying jobs and upward mobility for people.
You waited a bit to announce your reelection campaign. Was there ever a time that you weren't sure you were going to jump back in, run again?
Well, again, it's been an honor being governor, so I was highly confident during this entire process. But the Super Bowl is just a great time to launch. It worked well last time, and hopefully it's going to work well this time.
Governor Rick Snyder joining us from the road while he travels between campaign stops on this, the first day of his reelection campaign. Governor Snyder, thanks so much.
It was great to be with you. Have a great day.
So let's turn now to Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and my co-host of It's Just Politics. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Zoe, resident political junkie.
So we just heard from the governor the issues he'll be talking about, jobs, the economy. What are we going to hear from his likely opponent from the Schauer campaign?
Well, the Mark Schauer campaign is already on message, and they've got a few things going down. You know, one thing that's, you know, kind of interesting is that the governor's campaign got scooped on their own reelection announcement about 18 hours before they were going to announce the schedule. The Democrats got a hold of it and made sure that reporters knew. And so that got advanced by a bit of a day. So it was a little bit of, you know, almost this, you know, getting in their head game going on.
How does that happen that something like that gets released to the other side, to the opponent?
You know, it's going to be one of the mysteries of this campaign that we will try to turn up at some point, which is exactly how they got a hold of it. But as you can imagine, that they're not willing to share that quite yet. Mm-hmm. But it was sort of an interesting little kickoff. Although, I mean, we should point out that the fact that the governor announced he's running for re-election was no surprise, that he's made it clear. We even had an ad buy. The first real ad buy of the campaign was a few months ago. Another ad that opened with that image of the governor in scuba gear emerging from the lake.
Well, Rick, let's talk about that for a minute. For those that didn't see the governor's Super Bowl ad last night, it did, as you mentioned. It begins.
We should say a lot of people did not see the governor's Super Bowl ad because the game was such a blowout.
People were changing
by
the
halftime.
Channel.
People watched Bruno Mars and switched the station.
Fair enough, but the ad did start out. I mean, there is some talk about the fact that it was slightly interesting to start out with the governor scuba diving.
And this is comes from an ad shop that's sort of known for its quirky political ads, like, you know, the famous killer sheep ad and the Christine O'Donnell I Am Not a Witch ad. And this is one of it opens and you see a man in scuba gear underwater, and the camera pans to the surface and you see the governor come out and he takes off his face mask and his oxygen mouthpiece, and, you know, you see who it is, and it sort of, you know, symbolizes Michigan, you know, reemerging after the lost decade before it goes on. You never hear a word from Governor Snyder in this ad. That it's all the voiceover, you know, talking about the good things that have happened on Rick Snyder's watch, and then, you know, he reinforces that in his message that you know, much has been done. Still much to do, four more years.
Right. So the campaign spent some $700,000 on the ad, not the kind of money that the Schauer campaign has on hand. In fact, the first TV ad from the Schauer campaign wasn't even paid for by the Schauer campaign.
Right. Well, technically, it wasn't even a campaign ad. It was one of those so-called issue ads, mm-hmm. because it doesn't expressly call for anyone to vote. But it is an introduction to Mark Schauer. It is him. It's all him talking about his upbringing, his background, his parents. And then it closes with a plea from him that we need to stop Rick Snyder. So no explicit electioneering, vote for, vote against, vote for me, vote against me, just a general stop message. And, you know, like we said, that it actually isn't even officially, legally a campaign ad, although nobody, you know, who watches it would mistake it for anything else.
No, but what is the takeaway from the visuals of these two ads? I mean, you have Snyder at least post scuba gear. He's wearing a suit. And then in the shower ad, he comes out. He's wearing these sort of looks like hiking boots. He's wearing jeans.
Getting out of the car, stopping at the gas station, kind of small town, just a regular guy, you know, someone like you and me. He's just running for governor.
So the governor will spend today and tomorrow on campaign stops. Then on Wednesday, he's going to deliver his budget proposal. We're hearing leaks already that we're going to see an increase in education spending.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think that these numbers will probably be the most hard fought data in this campaign, which is what has been the fiscal impact of nerdonomics. Yes, that's what I called it. On schools. Did he cut education? Did he not cut education? That, you know, it was, it appears that, what the governor did with pensions and whatnot may be a net increase to schools, but it's not putting more teachers in the classroom, for example. So there's going to be a whole lot of back and forth about that. And we'll be spending plenty of time slicing and dicing that before the end of the campaign. Democrats will hit on the pension tax, which is extending the income tax to pensions, which is another issue that seems to be polling in the Democrats' favor in this campaign. And certainly, you know, as we pointed out, that you'll probably hear a lot of discussion about the minimum wage and economic disparities.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network and my co-host of It's Just Politics. Thanks, Rick.
Always a pleasure.
Meanwhile, Mark Schauer held a media conference call today, and just as Rick mentioned, Schauer took the governor to task over cuts to education.
Rick Snyder calls himself a tough nerd. Who has Rick Snyder been tough on? Certainly not the wealthy and the well-connected. He hasn't been tough on corporations, certainly not the corporations that benefited from his $1.8 billion tax cut. So who has Governor Rick Snyder been tough on? He's been tough on Michigan's kids. He took $1 billion out of education and handed it over to big corporations as part of a tax break that they didn't need and hasn't created a single job here in Michigan.
Democratic candidate for Governor Mark Schauer taking a jab at Governor Snyder as election 2014 heats up. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Detroit Emergency Manager Kevin Orr has submitted a so-called plan of adjustment to Detroit creditors. And if you can actually believe it, it's been about 6 months on a much warmer day back in July when Orr filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy for the city. So more than half a year later, what do local leaders in Michigan think about the bankruptcy? What does it mean for them? Is it giving them ideas about their own cities? Tom Avaco is here. He's with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Zoe. Thanks for having me.
So you've got a new survey out, and in it, you basically ask what I just did. What do you mayors, you leaders, think about Detroit's bankruptcy? What did you find?
Yeah, we talked to 1,350 local leaders across the state. 73% of all of our local leaders.
Big number.
Big number. Very accurate to get a statewide perspective.
Sure.
What we found is overall, 56% of these local leaders think that filing for bankruptcy was the right thing to do in this case.
And it looked like 11% disagreed.
Yeah. Very few think this was not the right thing to do.
Did those numbers surprise you?
They did surprise me. I would have expected higher opposition. 11% is awfully low.
Okay.
And 56% is a pretty good majority.
And did you break that down politically? You know, which leaders were Democrats,
yeah.
Which leaders were Republicans?
Yeah, we did. And this probably is one of the more surprising things in this report.
Okay.
Is there are not big partisan differences on this front. There are some small differences. Overall, 58% of Republican local leaders, 59% of independents think that bankruptcy is the right thing to do, but so do 55% of Democrats.
Wow.
Not big differences.
And it's interesting because, of course, we've heard the proposal now from Governor Snyder. He'd like to take $350 million from the state. This is money that the state gets from a big national tobacco settlement from back in the 90s.
Yeah.
Snyder wants to take this money, put it towards Detroit. What was the feeling among leaders about this money?
Well, they don't support additional state aid to help the city through its bankruptcy process. 57% of Michigan's local leaders think the state should not be providing new funds to Detroit. However, it's important to note we didn't ask about this specific kind of grand bargain that's being lined up.
Okay.
Our survey was in the field before that was announced.
Sure.
But still, 57% think the state should not be providing new funds to Detroit.
So let's talk about this dichotomy then, Tom Avocco. There's, you know, the leaders in this survey, they want a healthy Detroit, right? They believe that's important. They were okay with the bankruptcy, but then they don't want to have state money go to it. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, we asked a series of questions, two different batteries of questions about bankruptcy. One was specific about Detroit, and one was more general about what kind of trade-offs should be made when any municipality goes through bankruptcy, not specific to Detroit. And we found some interesting things there. In the more general sense, there's a little more support for a state coming in and providing some new financial support compared to the specific case of Detroit. Probably what that tells us is local leaders think Detroit caused some of its own problems and should solve some of its own problems.
I mean, of course, in all of this, there's the national image of Detroit. What do you find out about in terms of what these local leaders felt about what bankruptcy, just image speaking here, would mean for Detroit?
Yeah, they have concerns. They think, although they support the, you know, going to bankruptcy at this point, they do have concerns. And the most common concern that local leaders say is 54% of them think that the bankruptcy process is going to hurt Michigan's reputation. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, that's that could be a problem. Governor Snyder's working awfully hard to get the state of Michigan known as the comeback state. And so local leaders think that this bankruptcy process isn't going to help on that front. 43% of local leaders think that the bankruptcy process is going to make it more costly for other local governments to borrow money by issuing debt themselves.
Right.
And that's higher when we talk about just leaders from big jurisdictions, types of places that are more likely to be issuing debt. They're concerned that this could raise costs for them, for their own jurisdictions. And 41% of local leaders across the state think bankruptcy is going to make it more likely that other struggling jurisdictions will go bankrupt too.
And so, Tom, as we know, I mean, right, Detroit is not the only city, certainly in Michigan, facing these really serious financial problems. What's the takeaway when you look at these responses and where city leaders are feeling right now about themselves and if bankruptcy would be an option?
Well, I think overall, very few, you know, very small percentage of jurisdictions in Michigan are in this kind of outright fiscal crisis.
Absolutely. You've got certain cities, though. You've got a Flint, say. You've
That's
got
right.
cities under emergency management.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so we can't really single out our responses down to just those
few. Sure.
But, you know, overall, a relatively small percentage are really facing these kind of severe fiscal crisis. And so I think for the most part, you know, when we look statewide, most local leaders think they've been making tough decisions. They've been, you know, right-sizing their jurisdictions in these difficult times. And so there is, you know, certainly we found a lot of concern in our surveys over time about cuts in state aid. I think this is an ongoing issue for a lot of local governments across the state that think, yeah, the state has some role in what's happening here as well.
Yeah, and as sort of a side note here, when you ask these folks a question under the lines of if a city is under bankruptcy, what should that city do? And I was interested in this number about how they felt about current retirees' pensions, something that Detroit is really, really dealing with right now.
Yeah, we put 10 options in front of local leaders, and this was in our series of questions about not specific to Detroit, when any jurisdiction is going through bankruptcy, here are 10 different things that can be done, kind of fix the finances.
Right.
The only action out of those 10 options that there was a majority opposition to was cuts to pensions of current retirees. 51% of local leaders say that should not happen in bankruptcy.
And what's behind that? Is that just a political reason that it doesn't look good for a city to do, or because they genuinely think it can have economic impact?
I think we can't say exactly. We didn't ask specifically. My gut sense here is that local leaders think that current retirees made their deal. That train left the station. There was an agreement, and so it shouldn't be changed retroactively. Most of these pensions are, you know, relatively small amounts of money for individual retirees, and so I think local leaders tend to say these folks are not, you know, breaking the bank on their own. We made a deal with them too late for them to really take actions, these retirees, and so we should uphold our end of the bargain. I think the fact that Michigan's state constitution also guarantees that pensions won't be changed after the fact is
something
probably
we're
behind
seeing
this.
The attorney general dealing with right now here in our state. So finally, Tom, is there a way to use this data, these numbers? I mean, do you think it'll be interpreted by other cities as they figure out what's best for their own budgets?
Well, I think these findings are some of the first anywhere about the views of local leaders in terms of bankruptcy. And so I would expect that stakeholders should pay attention to these data just to get a sense of local leaders are the folks making decisions for governments all across, certainly the state of Michigan, across the nation. I think the finance industry, the public finance industry, probably doesn't know what local leaders think should be done in these difficult choices. And so this is really the first window into a wide swath of local leaders' views. I think it's a set of very interesting facts that can enlighten folks.
I was going to say a very, very interesting window when we look forward. Tom Evacco with the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the University of Michigan. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Zoe.
When the Winter Olympics begin in 3 days, there will be snow on the ground in Sochi, Russia, in part thanks to my next guest. Joe Vanderkellen is president of SMI Snowmakers in Midland, Michigan. Hi there, Joe.
Hi, Zoe. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. So you're making snow for the Olympics. How is this going to work?
Well, actually, most of the snow is already made for the venues over there.
Okay.
So they'll be having the Alpine, the freestyle, extreme, and snowboard events. And the course preparation is in full swing now.
So I think the question probably everyone is wondering is just how do you make snow?
Well, it takes a whole lot of water and a lot of technology and energy. And basically what we do is we take water and deliver it to the slopes and then break it into small particles and nucleate it or seed it with small ice crystals and then blow it out onto the slopes.
What's the hardest part while you're doing this? Is it finding the water?
Yeah, you know, what was great about Sochi is it was a new ski resort, so we kind of had a white sheet of paper, and we were fortunate enough to get up in a helicopter for a day or two, and we found a beautiful, clear, clean, cold water source running along a plateau near the finish zones, and we were able to build a couple of lakes, get the permission to build a couple of lakes there. So once we found this clear water that would fill these lakes by gravity, the whole system design really came together after that.
Now, Joe, you have made snow at previous Olympics. You're an old hand at this. Tell me, how does Sochi compare to the other cities where you've made snow?
Well, I think each Olympic venue's gotten a little more serious about the snow and the capability to make sure that there's going to be great snow at all the venues. So we've seen them embrace technology over the years, and the technology just keeps getting better. So this is a fully automated system with fiber optic communications, and everything can be controlled from a central computer or phones or tablets now. So it's truly quite a sophisticated technology that's being deployed at these Sochi Olympic Games.
Obviously, Joe, this is your living. I don't want you to badmouth it or anything, but I mean, there is this interesting dynamic, right? The Winter Olympics, it's supposed to be somewhere cold, and yet these cities are having to make snow.
Well, if you look around the world, most of the ski resorts make snow now, and they do it to ensure the best snow quality that's possible, and also to try to maximize the length of the season, and so that people can make vacation plans and have more predictability in when and where they can go and enjoy this great winter sport.
And Joe, are you going to be in Sochi for the games?
Yes, I will be going over to Russia. And very excited about that, and have some special credentials, so that makes it even more fun.
Wow. And finally, I just got to ask before we get you off the line, what is your favorite Olympic sport to watch? I'm assuming it has something to do with the snow.
Oh, yeah. You know, all the snow events, I think, are quite exciting. And, I particularly like the speed events, which are the men's and women's downhill and giant slalom events. But I also love the snowboard half pipe and the freestyle events as well. Can't really pick a top one. There's so many and there's such great sport involved that it's hard to pick a favorite.
Joe Vanderkellen is president of SMI Snowmakers in Midland, Michigan. Joe, safe travels.
Yeah, and I just encourage all your listeners to enjoy the games and get outside and enjoy this beautiful snow.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark in for Cynthia Canty.
The This place is dark and electric.
And that's Jerry Sprague. In 1985, Jerry quit his job and decided to follow his passion, music.
Like waves on the ocean. Swallows me deep from the shore.
But Jerry isn't the only person in his family with that passion. Jerry is in a band with his grandsons. So, Jerry, tell me how this all started.
Well, the whole family's musical. My father is 87 years old and still plays every Tuesday night at a VFW post on the west side of Lansing. I was in a band with my sons, and we traveled all over the upper Midwest in the early 90s as a band called Jerry and the Juveniles.
Now, three of your grandsons play music with you. Isaac is 21, Gabe 20, Samuel is 17. And I don't know, I guess when you think of rock bands traveling in their vans or tour buses, it's usually with people their own age. How does that work, you being the grandfather and being on tour with your three grandsons?
You know, until you see us, you really can't get wrap your head around it because it's hard to imagine. But we act more as peers than as relatives because we're all working for a common goal, which is creating good music.
Yeah, but there's got to be a time when you look at them and you just see that difference. You feel that difference in age.
There are times when we're rehearsing that I literally get a lump in my throat. You know, I was a very active grandfather with them. We're very close, probably closer than most grandparents and grandsons, but then we share this bond of music, too.
Right. Did you used to play music with them when they were babies, toddlers,
infants? We used to sing If You're Happy and You Know It types of songs. You know what I mean? So when they were little, we did a lot. I mean, I always had noisemakers and guitars laying around. More often than not, I would find peanut butter on the strings of my guitars, which was fine with me.
You know, you play right now, Jerry, in front of college students at bars late nights. What keeps you going?
This is an amazing way to work. And it's knowing the people. It's music is always new. You know, I'm always, because of the college students, they like hearing Johnny Cash and they like hearing Neil Diamond. But when Avicii came out with Wake Me Up, I had to learn that song. So it's always new.
And how does that work? I mean, there must be different influences for your grandsons from when they grew up and when you grew up. How do you reconcile that music together?
Somehow or other, they have embraced the poppy music that I have written, and not in a small way. They have really taken it to actually a whole other level because adding their personalities into the music that I've written makes it even fresher.
30 days before September, warmer days that I remember. Memory is all I've left to keep. This wistful preoccupation interrupts my hibernation. Images of this inside my sleep. I'm still in that summer state of mind. I'm still in that summer state of mind.
You were a father at a very young age.
Yeah.
You were a grandfather at a very young age.
Yes. 38 years old.
How has it affected your life? Do you think it's let you take more risks? I mean, this idea that you quit your job and decided to follow your passion?
I actually have 10 grandchildren. So I think if there's ever been any kind of positive reaction to all this is that those kids have watched me their entire life pursue my dream, and now they're in on it with me.
Yeah. I have to wonder, what is it like for your grandsons? I mean, when they tell their friends, their, you know, their buddies, yeah, I'm in a band with my grandpa. I mean, what is that like?
I encourage them to bring their friends to rehearsals, and when they get there, their friends are astounded. Because, you know, like I said, it's hard to wrap your head around this idea of, you know, young men and their grandfather performing music. But once they're there, once they're with us, they totally get it.
What would you tell other people who are looking at their families and maybe feel a disconnect, don't have that close relationship? What has that meant to you? And what would you tell other people who aren't able to quite figure out that relationship?
Oh, I think you have to take risks and reveal the person you are and include family members in your life a lot. And, some people have sports in common and some people have arts in common. I think the more that you find some sort of common interest, the more you're going to draw each other into each other's lives.
Will I ever know?
Well, Jerry Sprague, thank you so much for coming into the studio. Thanks for taking the time talking with us. It's just such a great story.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you, Zoe.
All these things I need to
Jerry Sprague's CD is Summer State of Mind.
Every day I need to tell her. Every day I want to tell her. Every day.
This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. It's been 20 years since NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, went into effect January 1st, 1994, drastically changing the economic relationship between Canada, the U.S., and Mexico. While signing the bill into law, then-President Clinton said NAFTA means jobs, American jobs, and good-paying jobs. So let's spend the next little while taking stock of NAFTA and what it's meant particularly to Michigan, its economy, the auto industry, the state's workers. Joining us now are Patrick Anderson, CEO of the Michigan-based Anderson Economic Group, and Harley Shaken, professor at UC Berkeley who specializes in labor and the global economy. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here, Zoe.
Now, the idea of the North American Free Trade Agreement, although we often think of President Clinton signing the bill, it actually began under President Reagan. That's when negotiations began. And it was bipartisan. Both Democrats and Republicans voted for it. But let's jump 20 years later from all of that to today. And let's start with the simple question that most likely does not have a simple answer. Harley, did NAFTA do what it was supposed to do?
No, it did not. NAFTA was sold as doing two things. First, creating a lot of jobs in the U.S. The projections that were used were several hundred thousand the first year alone. And then improving living standards in Mexico, and the U.S. and Mexico would converge in an upward direction. During the initial debate, the fireworks was not about the free trade arrangement with Canada, because these were two very similar societies economically, with a similar standard of living and roughly similar environmental and labor laws in terms of their enforcement. With Mexico, this was the first time that a developing and highly industrial economy were brought together in a free trade agreement. So what's happened? NAFTA was supposed to give us a trade surplus with Mexico, generating jobs. The year before it was passed, we had almost a $5 billion trade surplus with Mexico. For the last 3 years, we've had a $100 billion-plus trade deficit with Mexico. The result of a deficit of that scale is certainly a downward pressure on employment, but also the issue of inequality in Mexico in some ways has been exacerbated by NAFTA. In manufacturing over the last 20 years, the average productivity has gone up by 80%. In Mexico. That means the average worker has produced 80% more. That's impressive and positive. But average compensation, wages and benefits, have gone down by 20%.
And Patrick, as Harley just mentioned, I mean, there's this number, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of jobs moving to Mexico. What do you say to opponents of NAFTA who say it's been, you know, it's been a job loss for the states?
Well, I disagree with the notion that hundreds of thousands of jobs have moved to Mexico in isolation, as if that's the only thing that happened.
Sure.
Or the main effect of NAFTA.
Sure.
And I'm sure if Harley continued on with what he was talking about, he would have described some of the other things that I'll talk about now. NAFTA may or may not have been oversold in Washington, D.C. I would have to say that most things that pass in Washington, D.C. are hugely oversold. And this one, if it was oversold on a modest basis for Washington. But it did promise growth in jobs and income across the entire continent compared with what would have happened if we didn't open up trade. And the question of whether trade increases overall economic well-being and jobs has been studied and has been debated for at least 200 years. Adam Smith talked about it back in 1776 about corn and about the then nascent mechanization that was going on. Clearly, we would have, if we did not have NAFTA, the automobile industry would not look anything like it does today. And there's a chance that it would not be nearly as vibrant. In fact, it may not even be centered on Detroit anymore. It may have been moved almost entirely to other countries. That is not the case now. You can look at the automobile industry, and the center of the world automobile industry still has to be, when you look at those centers, you still have to look at Japan, Germany, and Detroit as the centers. So in terms of whether it has maintained jobs, clearly it's different, and clearly in terms of manufacturing, not just in Mexico, but all over the world, you see huge growths in productivity per worker hour, and you see changes in compensation that are usually a lot better than the statistics that Harley talked about for Mexico, but not in the same range of ratio of growth. But you do have manufacturing here, and you have a great, vibrant automobile industry that continues for 20 years on. It did not, as some of the people who feared, go wholesale to Mexico, go wholesale to Taiwan. It didn't go to China. We still don't have any, by the way, passenger cars from China sold in the United States from any major automaker, because the U.S. auto market is so hard to get into in terms of not trade barriers, in terms of quality. Consumers just demand a lot.
Get this out of contention. I think trade can be very positive, and I think expanded trade can be even better. But it does depend on the rules of the game. The problem with NAFTA isn't trade between the U.S. and Mexico, but rules of the game that say, look, intellectual property rights are critical, that's appropriate, we'll put strong language. Profits are critical, that's appropriate, we'll put strong language. But when it comes to labor standards and the environment, it was virtually silent in terms of its impact. And that has resulted in a very unbalanced situation. A trade agreement gives us, in effect, the same economy with profoundly different standards when it comes to workers and the environment. Let me give one statistic on the auto industry.
Sure.
Mexico now exports more auto parts to the U.S. than Japan, than Germany, than Korea. In fact, it exports more auto parts to the U.S. than all those three countries combined. We run a $42 billion trade deficit with Mexico in auto parts alone. There's something wrong with that picture. We could have a productive, positive, growing trade relation with Mexico, but we need rules of the game that ensure that working families in both countries benefit from that.
Harley Shaken, professor at UC Berkeley, who specializes in labor and the global economy. Also on the line, Patrick Anderson, CEO of the Michigan-based Anderson Economic Group, talking about NAFTA, its effects on Michigan 20 years later. And Patrick, I want to get on to that point. Ask Bob King, the UAW's current president, about NAFTA at 20, and you will get the answer. He said, it's been a disaster to me. So, Patrick, is there a difference between what NAFTA has meant for big corporations and what it's actually meant for the everyday worker?
I think it's been positive both for giant corporations, middle-sized corporations, most small companies, and definitely for workers. And I want to point again to what was the potential 20 years ago. And those of us who lived in Michigan 20 years ago and saw what I thought was often a very bad side of the country I love, but the country's character sometimes reacts to immigrants or foreign threats in a manner that's very ugly. And there was a lot of what I'll call out and out Japan bashing 20 years ago. And if you go back in the 80s, even worse, there was the specter of, driving tanks over Japanese cars.
Yeah.
There was a lot of very ugly rhetoric, as if, you know, these people usually, or sometimes at least, termed in a very ugly way, were taking our jobs and everything. That didn't happen. Now you have an automobile industry in which American car makers compete at the top quality levels, in which they compete in almost every segment, and in which Japanese nameplate auto companies such as Honda and Toyota manufacture, assemble in the United States, and where, quote, American companies are actually integrated across Mexico, Canada, and the United States as well. And you even have German companies such as Volkswagen, such as Mercedes, such as BMW assembling in the United States. If you look at that industry, you see that these claims that we would lose all of manufacturing and the United States would turn into a race to the bottom, that just hasn't happened. That's not to say that what Harley's talking about in terms of environmental protections in other countries is not something that is of some concern. It's not to say that NAFTA handled every aspect of international trade and societies. It didn't. I do think on intellectual property, which he raised, NAFTA does have some intellectual property protections, and you have a lot of companies that will do business in NAFTA countries, but not in China, where there is a serious, serious issue with intellectual property protection. So I think it has been very good for workers. It's been very good for employers. And over a 20-year period, it's hard to say that something's good for workers but not employers or vice versa. Was it good for the United Auto Workers? That I can't say. I think the United Auto Workers, as well as many other parties, including the management of the companies involved, has a lot to answer for in terms of the bankruptcy of General Motors and Chrysler. That occurred in a NAFTA environment, and it had already started before NAFTA went into play. So I think a lot of things happened there, and I can't second guess the president of the UAW's opinion of whether the UAW is benefited or not from NAFTA. Clearly, he has an idea about that that's superior to mine. But in terms of workers, workers actually have more opportunity now across a number of industries in the United States, Canada, and Mexico than they would have had without NAFTA.
Harley, your response?
I don't think the numbers bear that out at all. Overall, the Mexican economy is too small in relation to the U.S. To have an overwhelming impact. But if you look at NAFTA as a model for global trade, were this generalized with all countries, it would be very damaging in the U.S. That rising productivity and quality in Mexico means that workers produce more and earn less. We have a similar problem, but not as extreme in the U.S., and NAFTA exacerbates that. Does that mean we couldn't have a productive trade relation with Mexico? Of course not. We could have a very productive relationship. But imagine if you said to Microsoft, look, we want to expand trade with Mexico, but we're not going to protect your intellectual property rights. Let the market sort that out by itself. Microsoft wouldn't remotely want to go into a trade relationship under those conditions, and they'd be right not to. But that's exactly what we've said to working families in the U.S. Labor standards and their enforcement in Mexico, well, whatever. And the net result is it's fed into our own inequality problem, and some estimates put the job loss as high as 1 million in manufacturing.
Now, we just have a few minutes left here, and I want to look towards two more trade deals that are in the works right now. We have the Trans-Pacific Partnership with 11 countries and then a free trade agreement with Europe. Harley, let's start with you. Looking at we know now about NAFTA, how skeptical do you think we should be about these two new trade agreements?
Very skeptical, particularly the Trans-Pacific Partnership. It would be buying a series of Brooklyn bridges given that all the defects in NAFTA, if anything, had been exacerbated in the context of some of the 11 countries that we would be signing a trade agreement with. In this case, the Senate Majority Leader, Harry Reid, just last week came out very forcefully against it, and many, many Democrats and some Republicans in the Congress are coming out against it. Again, it's not opposition to trade, but it's wanting to ensure that trade benefits ordinary families, improves the middle class, and results in a trading relationship that generates jobs for everyone. The flip side of low wages in Mexico is low purchasing power. That diminishes our ability to export, contributes to a $100 billion trade deficit. That's what we're looking at with the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The agreement with Europe also has its own complications that have not really been forcefully addressed. We talk about the rhetoric of free trade, but we forget it's the rules of the game. The devil is in the details. We want trade that expands the middle class.
Patrick, as Harley noted, you've got President Obama pushing for these, but it looks like his fellow Democrat, as we heard Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, is saying not so fast. Is that fair?
That has been the pattern with Democratic presidents for a long time, and that and Democratic members of Congress. Often Democratic members of Congress feel a lot more pressure from labor unions to oppose these, and in more recent decades from what has emerged as more powerful elements of the Democratic Party, such as the environmental organizations, and they often take a much narrower view of the national interest than presidents do. I don't want to go into the details of bills that are introduced as much as Harley did, but I'll have to say, free trade benefits people. It benefits them because it lets them have more work opportunities, and it benefits them because they're able to buy things that are less expensive and have things and spend less of their time wasted on things that they can't do as well as somebody else, or let things rot at borders and be inefficient. It does disrupt things, undoubtedly. But if you look at the 20-year history of NAFTA, you look at a Mexico that now sends about 66% of its exports to the United States, Canada a little bit less, and the United States exporting a lot to Canada and Mexico. And apparently about one-third of what Mexico exports to the United States, they bought in parts from us. So there's a lot of exporting that gets re-exported. I think that's unambiguously good. The United States has been generally a beacon of free trade. We have our dark moments, most notably Smoot-Hawley during the Depression, which hurt everybody. I'm much more happy with the direction toward the United States leading towards free trade, setting an example, helping other countries improve their standard of living, and also helping our own workers and consumers doing that. And I think that overcompensates us for what are undoubtedly disruptions that occur anytime when you open doors and windows.
Patrick Anderson, CEO of the Michigan-based Anderson Economic Group, and Harley Shaken, professor at UC Berkeley, who specializes in labor and the global economy. A really interesting conversation. We'll have to have you both on again. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you.
All right, great to be on. Great to talk to you again.
For me as well, Patrick.
And that is Stateside. The show was directed today by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Haddle, Katie Suha, and Claire Tennisketter. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Zoe Clark, sitting in today for Cynthia Canty. She will be back tomorrow. Thank you so much for listening.